Last year, the bipartisan 9/11 Commission issued a report on the 2001 terrorist attacks, which included a host of recommendations on how best to prevent future threats to the nation's security. Since then, the former commissioners have reconvened to issue a series of follow-up reports which examine the government's progress on those reforms. Here in Washington today, they released the second document in their series, the topic, intelligence. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Lee Hamilton, the former vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission, and he'll be taking your calls. If you have questions about government preparedness after 9/11, if you work in Homeland Security or intelligence, call us. Tell us what's changed. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. And Lee Hamilton, a former 9/11 vice chairman and former member of Congress, joins us here. He's current vice chair of the 9/11 Public Discourse Project, the group established to continue the goals of the original bipartisan commission. Congressman Hamilton, nice to have you on the program, as always.
Thank you.
Before we talk specifically about intelligence, why do the former commissioners believe it's important to come out with these report cards, if you will?
We made 41 recommendations. A number of them have been adopted. A number of them have not been. We're very serious about these recommendations. We think they will help make the American people more secure. And so we banded together in a private organization, really. We raised money separately for it in order to try to get more of the recommendations implemented.
Well, let me ask you about some of the specific recommendations and how you think, how you and the commission think the government and Congress have done. Director of National Intelligence was one of your primary recommendations. That was enacted in the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. John Negroponte has since been sworn in as the new Director of National Intelligence. Yet you give them some progress on this part?
Yes, we do. You're right. The framework for the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and his authorities over budget and personnel, transfer authorities, are in place. But, of course, that's not enough. To ensure success, he's got to exercise those authorities. He's got to put together this new National Counterterrorism Center and the structure of his own office. He's in the process of doing that. Good progress has been made, but I think there's a long distance to go before you really have a fully functioning Director of National Intelligence Office.
On that National Counterterrorism Center, you say so far, that's also been established, but so far it has about one half of the necessary analytic capability and one third of the necessary personnel.
Well, that's right. It, too, is a work in progress. Now, the importance of this is that the National Counterterrorism Center is where all of the information comes together from the various, some 15 intelligence organizations. It becomes the primary place where we analyze intelligence. They are in the process of getting the people their need. As you know, there's enormous competition in this government today for good, highly trained analysts. So getting a full core of analysts together is not quite as easy as it sounds. They're in the progress of doing it. The purpose of all of this is to unify the intelligence effort and the operational response to terrorism.
Let's move on to the FBI, for whom you have some harsh words. Information systems at the FBI were a scandal, I think it's fair to say, before 9/11, and you say progress since then has been unsatisfactory. The FBI culture, you say, continues to resist Director Mueller's changes. Initiatives to improve information technology capabilities have failed.
Well, if you look at the FBI, first of all, there isn't any doubt that Director Mueller is dramatically changing the direction of the FBI. Its tradition, of course, has been law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's trying to make the principal mission of the FBI prevention of terrorism. That is a huge shift for the FBI, and he deserves a lot of credit for pushing this forward in a significant way. Having said that, we believe there are significant deficiencies in the FBI's analytical capabilities, for example. We think this information sharing with other agencies, particularly state and local officials, is not as smooth as it ought to be. We think there's too much turnover in the leadership of the FBI at the top levels. And, of course, you mentioned the information technology problem, upon which the FBI spent, I think, some $170 million or so without much result. They're working very hard on that now to correct it, but they've got miles and miles to go yet.
One thing, and obviously we can't cover every specific area, but homeland airspace defense, you would think a primary subject of interest in the aftermath of 9/11. You say, after 4 years after 9/11, no single agency leads the interagency response to airspace violations. There is no overarching plan that exists to secure airspace outside of the National Capital Region, meaning here in Washington, D.C. Agencies do not have a common definition of an airspace violation.
Well, that's exactly right. There is just not the kind of progress that you would like to see. I think overall the situational awareness has improved. You do have now this National Capital Region Coordination Center with representatives from the military and the civilian agencies in place, but you do not have yet what we describe in our statement as an overarching plan. Information's not shared as well as it should be, and they, too, have quite a ways to go. Mm-hmm.
These are all focused on the executive branch, and we'll get to Congress in a few minutes because they have some responsibilities for this too, but we want to get some listeners involved in the conversation in terms of reviewing the progress on intelligence reform since the publication of the 9/11 Commission report. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us, but let's get a caller on the line. This is Robert. Robert calling us from Las Vegas.
Yes, I'm very concerned about the information trickling down to our local, basically local law enforcement here in Las Vegas. We have huge big business with our casinos, and it just seems like our local authorities seem to know, you know, what's going on more than the, you know, than the federal agencies. And I was just wondering, and you know, why it took so long. And also, the only time we hear, you know, really any tips or anything is like after the fact, you know, that the FBI goes, well, an agency took this call and they presumed that there was something going to happen. Mm-hmm. But this happens later on. And I was wondering, why don't they just generate that there's actual link, a real quick link to figure out what they can do to better the information?
I think the caller, Robert, is making a very, very good point, and he's put his finger, I believe, on one of the real weaknesses at this point. Information is beginning, I think, to be shared now within the federal government, among the various agencies. The big problem is getting this information to thousands of local and state jurisdictions. And incidentally, this is a two-way process. The local and state people have a lot of information the federal people need. They're the ones on the ground. So this whole area of communication, information sharing has to be sharply improved.
We just saw that incident the other day in Baltimore where the harbor tunnels were closed down, or one of them was closed down and the other one was partially closed down, the basis apparently of information from overseas. And after all of it, the mayor of Baltimore said, gee, it would have been nice to hear about this.
Well, it was in Baltimore, New York City. The positive thing here is, at least in the New York City case, information is beginning to be shared. The problem was in the New York case, I don't know about the Baltimore case.
It just happened the other day. So
that's correct. In the New York case, information was shared, but they put a different interpretation on that information. The New York mayor had different responsibilities from the federal authorities. He took the very conservative approach and said, look, we've got to put these security steps into operation immediately. And then as the information developed more, the intelligence developed more, I think there was broader agreement that the sources were not credible or not all that credible. It's important to keep in mind here that when you get an alert like that, you don't have a final product so far as the intelligence is concerned. That takes hours and sometimes days to develop. But during that period, you have to make a number of operational decisions. And so it becomes a very dynamic process and one that's exceedingly difficult to carry out. We had some glitches in it. The fact of the matter is we do not yet have the communication from Washington to the state and local people, as Robert was saying a moment ago, and we've got a lot of work to do.
Robert, thanks very much for the call.
So I have one more thing. I was wondering why, you know, some people are afraid to actually, you know, put, you know, they think their job's on the line. So instead of that, they're very hesitant to say something. You know, I want them to say, okay, maybe, you know, we think there's a big terror, and we may, and if they were wrong, you know what, it's better to be wrong and safe than sorry than to just say, well, you know, we just didn't want to do anything. And our local authorities do that. They practice out there. They do bomb scare. They do practice things at the mall. And, you know, for just about everything, a terrorist act, a biochemical attack, and we do that.
It
doesn't seem like the government's ever really put any money or put forth any effort to do that.
It takes a lot of coordination and cooperation between and among the various authorities. I would certainly commend Las Vegas for the manner in which you're proceeding. It'll take us a while to get this right, and among the most important things we have to do is, you have indicated, is to get this information flow better between federal and local officials.
Thanks again, Robert.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Lee Hamilton, former vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission and formerly a congressman from Indiana, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And as I mentioned, there are some bad grades for Congress as well. One of the things that you proposed was the establishment of, for example, a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. That was provided for in the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Act. To date, you conclude, no meetings have been held, no staff has been named, no work plan has been outlined, no work has begun, no office has been established 10 months after the establishment of the board by statute. It shows few signs of life.
Well, that's what we said, and I think we're right on it. The statute provided for the creation of this Civil Liberties Oversight Board for the protection of civil liberties and privacy. It doesn't have funding. It doesn't have staff. It hasn't had meetings. The people have been named, but there's just not enough push behind this, and we think the progress here has been minimal. The Senate needs to act expeditiously on the nominees for the chair and the vice chair. The Congress has to provide sufficient funding, and these folks have to get to work. The one thing you can say for sure is, as we have moved into the deal with the threat of terrorist attack, we have expanded very substantially the role of government, not just in terms of money, but also in terms of intrusiveness into the lives of people. And when you do that, most of us think much of it is necessary because of the threat. But at the same time, when you do it, you have to be alert to the invasion of civil liberties. And therefore, the commission recommended a very robust civil liberties board, and it's not functioning yet.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Robert. Robert with us from Lynchburg, Virginia.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'd also like to say thank you to, it's a pleasure to speak to my former representative. I'm from Southern Indiana originally. My question for you is, I'm wondering to what extent has the cooperation with foreign intelligence agencies been strengthened? And I will take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Robert.
Well, Robert, my friend from Southern Indiana, makes a good point also, because when you talk about information sharing, you think first, of course, of information sharing within and among our government and with, as we were mentioning a moment ago, state and local officials. But the fact of the matter is foreign intelligence agencies have a lot of information that's very important to us. And so the flow of information both ways, say with the UK or with Israel or with France or any number of other countries, has to be sharply improved. I think steps here are being taken that will improve that flow of intelligence. You have to have some appreciation here that governments are asked to share their top secrets with other governments, and that makes some resistance pop up. But having said that, I think our key intelligence officials have been meeting now regularly with intelligence officials across the world, and I'm encouraged. But I would say here what I've said with other things, it's still developing. We haven't gotten it quite right yet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of progress still needs to be made.
And indications that other countries also have problems with this, the friction between France and Britain over the intelligence regarding last summer's attacks in England, that also illustrated their difficulties. But let's get another caller on the line.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk with James. James with us from Vienna, Virginia. James, are you there? Hello, James. I guess James isn't with us. One of the things that you also talk about is, again, one of the problems before 9/11 was lack of language skills in the intelligence agencies. Has that been repaired?
Not very far. You don't develop a high-level linguist in a matter of a few months or even a few years. And, of course, the government's searching all over the place now for good Arabic speakers. One of these agencies that we've talked about, the Defense Department, the CIA, the FBI, many, many others, are looking very hard now for speakers of language. Back in the old days of the Cold War, we wanted people who could speak Russian. Today, we want people that can speak 15 or 20 more esoteric languages, and they're very hard to come by. I saw this article in the newspaper over the weekend where we have 8 fluent Arabic speakers in the Department of State.
Eight.
Only 8 that have the highest rating Arabic competency level. Well, that tells you something of the problem, and it is a huge one. Having said that, if you go to the FBI today or the CIA, they will tell you they are bringing in a lot of Arabic speakers. Well, now, one other problem here is that to find the most fluent Arabic speakers, you usually have to go to people who spoke the language as children. They grew up with it in a bilateral, perhaps a bilingual atmosphere, and they almost always will have a considerable foreign background, which means a lot of checking for security, and that slows the process.
Congressman Hamilton, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Lee Hamilton, former vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission. If you'd like to read the recommendations, you can go to www.911pdp.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.